This is Jason Horsley in a hammock on the 14th of July 2018. It's a week before I hit the skies traveling to Europe, so I'm going to attempt to record a solo podcast so that I have something for my listeners while I'm on the road in case I don't manage to have sufficient conversations to keep up the weekly podcast, but also because this is something that I've been wanting to do since I started reading Simone Weil's Gravity and Grace, which I shared at the blog via PDF and an excerpt from the introduction. It's been a while since I read a book that I wanted to do this with. I think the last one was The Politics of Ritual Abuse Beyond Disbelief. It's very hot today, and that's going to cause me to slow down even more than usual, I'd say. I'll cut out the gaps and pauses if I do air this to spare you all. But I'd say that there is something. There's a correlation between what I've been reading, Simone Weil, some of the things she describes, and how I've been feeling lately, particularly acutely. It could be related to the hot weather. Could also be related to getting ready for a Devashana retreat. But I think it's more general, more ongoing than that. What it has to do with is a lack of will, a feeling of inertia, feeling of apathy, of exhaustion, of fatigue. Of course, I suffered from chronic fatigue for many years, but I wouldn't say that this is the equivalent of that when I suffered from that. It's not so much physical tiredness or fatigue, but mental, psychological, emotional, spiritual, existential fatigue. It's the feeling that everything is too much effort, and of being defeated or stymied at a very basic existential level. And I think this has to do with spiritual knowledge to some degree, but I think it goes deeper than that. I think it's, well, I'm not going to speculate too much. I'm just giving that as a background, a context for my being impacted by Simone Weil, Gravity and Grace, and a certain degree of ambivalence about adhering too much to written words, to conceptual language that's not really practical. It's philosophical, it's mystical. I've learned not to trust beautiful turns of phrases, seemingly profound concepts. But even so, I'm going to share this. I'm going to read from it and see how it feels reading it out loud. See if it invokes or provokes any responses from me, which would be then possibly of use to you if there is a second or third person involved. I'd say it's a third person because I'm going to begin this as a dialogue between the late Simone Weil and myself, my present self. He who believes in God is in danger of a still greater illusion, that of attributing to grace what is simply an essentially mechanical effect of nature. That's a fucking asshole on the street now listening to bullshit rock and roll. Okay, he's moved on. Just in case you were wondering what that was, wasn't by choice. This has coincided quite well with my recent passage from, oh, I don't even know what, but my recent dabbling in Christian doctrine, skirting around the edges of Christian dogma and conversion. And this is a notion that I'd say I've been aware of for a long time, but that it's crystallized by reading Simone Weil, that belief in God, such has become much more concrete for me recently, at least in terms of expressing it or mentally formulating it, let's say, or holding it in my awareness as an idea. I believe in God, that idea, is perhaps certainly as likely, but perhaps even more likely to prevent an experience of God or the divine as or than it is to facilitate it. And I have known people in my life, of course my brother would be the most extreme example, too extreme really perhaps to be a good one, who have professed to be atheists and to reject God, belief in God, and yet their lives and their actions and many of the other things they've said have sort of belied that. These are people who seem to have an innate sense of the implicate order and meaning and purpose of things that itself presupposes a God or supreme being or intelligence, whatnot. And I think that this has been a partly conscious strategy on their part and on my part, also to the extent that I have rejected belief, orthodox belief, that insofar as my concepts about what God is are inadequate, impoverished, they do a disservice to the reality that I'm attempting to experience, or talk about, and therefore to myself. The Tao that can be named is not the Tao, and all that, and so on. The God that can be thought about or believed in is not the one true God. How's that for a paradox? Humility consists in knowing that in what we call I, there is no source of energy by which we can rise. Humility consists in knowing that in what we call I, there is no source of energy by which we can rise. Perfect joy excludes even the very feeling of joy, for in the soul filled by the object, no corner is left for saying I. We cannot imagine such joys when they are absent, thus the incentive for seeking them is lacking. This speaks to my experience in my 50s, early 50s now, because as with God, the more, well, how can I even phrase this? The more I've come to understand what things like spirituality and God and truth and beauty and meaning and purpose and joy, all the good things, essentially, even though they can't be represented by concepts or words, the more I come to understand about their nature, the more I've come to understand that experiencing them directly through one's thoughts and feelings or even sensations, which I'd say is the subtlest level of our being, of our conscious being, or intuition, of course. There's another one that's perhaps even more subtle. It doesn't seem to be required for an experience of them to happen. So that's a contradiction, but for me to be aware in this very dim, distant way that something is possible, that something is palpable and real, without being able to refer to conscious criteria of thought, feeling, vision, hearing, sensation, smell, intuition, any of those things. And yet somehow to have this sense that something is there, that seems to correspond with an increased sense of futility and despair and a lack of will and purpose in my existence that is somehow nested in this deeper sense of knowing that it's okay, that it's that it's beyond my volition anyway, that that anything I can refer to as me, as coming from me or coming to me, I can't act upon it anyway. I can't act upon it. I can't make it an object of my will. So then humility consists in recognizing that I'm only included in the experience of these things, these higher values of existence, insofar as I'm invited into them or touched by grace. And then even only so far as my attention is sufficiently away from all of my own surface perceptions to notice it, which is mostly not at all. An imaginary divinity has been given to man so that he may strip himself of it like Christ did of his real divinity. So that's the crucial fiction. We believe in something so that we can have the experience of letting go of the belief, seeing what remains. This is from Necessity and Obedience on page 44. We should do only those righteous actions which we cannot stop ourselves from doing, which we are unable not to do. But through well-directed attention, we should always keep on increasing the number of those which we are unable not to do. We should not take one step, even in the direction of what is good, beyond that to which we are irresistibly impelled by God, and this applies to action, word, and thought. But we should be willing to go anywhere under his impulsion, even to the farthest limit, the cross. To be willing to go as far as possible is to pray to be impelled, but without knowing whither. I'd say that that's something that's also been becoming more conscious and more embodied with age. Is, well, I once said that my first 40 years was all about facing the fear, my fears about doing what things I wanted to do and doing them because I was afraid of doing them. And after that, things gradually shifted so that now it's become about facing my fears and not doing the things that I'm afraid of not doing. I put it in a different way as well, which is that I used to believe it was better to regret doing something than not doing something, because at least one was gathering experience by committing regrettable acts. Since I turned 40 thereabouts, that reversed, and I decided or realized that it was now time to risk regretting not doing things. And I would say that one area in which I do feel satisfied is that my life has certainly been filled with regret of doing things that I really didn't need to do. Like, it would be hard for me to look back on my life and feel that I had been remiss in terms of taking risks. And so, yeah, I could say that my one regret about, how do I rephrase that? I don't regret, the main thing that I don't regret about my past is that it's so full of regrets. So that I know that I lived to the full and then some until my cup floweth over. And, of course, that might be sophistry. I mean, I had to turn it into a clever little paradox, but pointing towards something that's real, that I feel a sort of baseline of satisfaction about that I have I pushed myself to limits, so I know that those limits exist, and so I don't have to regret that. At least, and that's a big thing, to regret that one might have backed away from experience when it was beckoning. And of course, the other side of that isn't, it doesn't mean that there can't be deep regret and loss of experience. Because now the realization that is growing is that because my cup was so full, it left no room for true experience of what is of greatest value. And so now I'm becoming more and more aware that it's better not to act. And if there's a fear about acting, if I feel that there's a tension in me between the pressure to act or speak and a fear or anxiety about it, then it's best for me to simply let go of the desire to act and let the fear act as a check. Well, I'm afraid, so I won't do it, because that way I don't have to be afraid anymore. If I let go of the desire to do it, I don't have to be in fear of that. I can just relax, because I know that there's nothing inherently worth doing unless it's being done for the right reasons, or unless there's a true impulse to do it. And when there's a true impulse, there's no fear. It's simply because there's no gap between the impulse and the action, essentially. I mean, even if it's a decision to do something in the future, one can act on it right away in such a way. But I'm mostly talking about social inhibitions here, because those are the greatest, I'd say, the most palpable. Learning to relax among other people. But also, I mean, how that can slowly seep into my being with myself, because myself is also other people. I have many inner selves who are putting pressure and demanding things and so on. Every act should be considered from the point of view not of its object but of its impulsion. The question is not what is the aim, it is what is the origin. Now, I wouldn't say that that's something that I can analyze, like, is this coming from God or my soul or not? But again, just learning to recognize when an impulse is irresistible is not to say that there's a struggle, I can't resist it, I must give in, but just that it flows so naturally that I don't have to add any energy to it. Don't have to add the force of my own will to it. And so then the impulse and the act are one, and that means that the act is one with the source of action. At least in theory. I can't say that this is always going to be the case 100% of the time, but it's as best as I can do to describe it. Good which is done in this way, almost in spite of ourselves, almost shamefacedly and apologetically, is pure. All absolutely pure goodness completely eludes the will. Goodness is transcendent. God is goodness. Well, I'm hesitant to talk about the Thriftster again, because I'm becoming more aware, reading Simeon Weil, that the more I talk or think about the Thriftster as a kind of virtuous activity that I have, the less virtuous it becomes by this very principle that if one is doing good because one is aware that it is good to do it, then it ceases to be good in that pure sense. That's that one does good because one simply has to. It's an irresistible impulse, so to speak. It just happens. And this is why I think she's pointing out that actually, if there's a shamefacedness or a reluctance or a resistance to doing the good, but one does it anyway, that's a better gauge or as good a gauge as perhaps there is that good is happening through one, not that one is really doing it, but one is allowing oneself to do good in spite of oneself. And that's absolutely my experience in the thrift store, that I just feel like this really is galling to me, to be acting in ways that are better than I feel that I am or that I should be or need to be. But doing it simply because Well, it's right. I mean, it just feels right. It's very strange because it feels wrong, but the part of me it feels wrong to, it feels right to ignore. Because I know that part well enough to not trust it and not give it what it wants. So then what I enjoy is not, I do enjoy doing good or doing what is helpful to people, but I think what I enjoy more is saying no to that part of me that's telling me to resist this because it's humiliating. So it's back to humility, recognizing that what comes from my own will is never good. Man has to perform an act of incarnation, for he is disembodied, disincarnate, by his imagination. What comes to us from Satan is our imagination. Why is the determination to fight against the prejudice a sure sign that one is full of it? Such a determination necessarily arises from an obsession. It constitutes an utterly sterile effort to get rid of it. In such a case, the light of attention is the only thing which is effective, and it is not compatible with polemical intention. This is a quote that I wish to use for my Identity Politics series, because I think that this is one of the main things that I'm working out, working through, in terms of liminality and liminalism, in terms of how my focus is always on things that I perceive as wrong or erroneous. So it's as if there's always a danger I'm fighting against a prejudice, which indicates there's something in me that is being mirrored by that, and so I'm trying to get rid of something outside of me that is in me, and then that relates to an obsessive quality. So hence I'm always attempting to bring it back to simply attention, like I'm just putting my attention on this to see what's there. Always reminding myself that that's the principle that I'm attempting to adhere to here. I'm certainly preaching it, so I'm doing my best to practice it as well. We must be careful about the level on which we place the infinite. If we place it on the level which is only suitable for the finite, it will matter very little what name we give it. That's back to a concept of God being an obstacle to an experience of God. God and the supernatural are hidden and formless in the universe. It is well that they should be hidden and nameless in the soul. Otherwise, there would be a risk of having something imaginary under the name of God. Those who fed and clothed Christ did not know that it was Christ. This is the meaning of the ancient mysteries. Christianity, Catholic and Protestant, speaks too much about holy things. That is why there is not any love of truth without an unconditional acceptance of death. The cross of Christ is the only gateway to knowledge. That was on page 57. If you want to know what it was the end of the paragraph, then you can read it there. I have to whiz through this bit because there's a lot that I've marked, and well, I can always go back to it again if people like this. We do not have to acquire humility. There is humility in us. Only we humiliate ourselves before false gods. To love purely is to consent to distance. It is to adore the distance between ourselves and that which we love. This is again why I feel, or the reason I mark that passage is because it echoes my experience of the spiritual path that I'm on, that I'm less and less willing to refer to as a spiritual path at all. It's so much more about absence than presence. It's so much more about distance than proximity. It's so much more about lacking and longing and falling short, and it is about attaining or finding or achieving. There's less and less of a sense of achievement in my life. And paradoxically, that's the greatest sense of achievement that I have, is recognizing that I'm achieving less and being more okay with it. Now, I'm not referring to worldly stuff. I'd say that in a worldly sense, I'm probably achieving more, or about the same, probably a little bit more, in terms of recognition, validation, and certainly in terms of how I feel about my accomplishments as a writer, I'd say that they're probably getting better. Speaker, probably the same. Not too sure, really. but that's the point. It's not that important to me. I'd say my satisfaction is more fleeting but deeper. So in that way, more meaningful, even though it's more fleeting. And that seems to me to be to do with becoming closer to the present, in which the only real satisfaction can occur is in the present. And not only does it not have to be to last, because it's enough unto the moment, but it can't. Like, because if I'm enjoying the afterglow of last moment satisfaction, then I'm not putting my attention on what's in the present. And yeah, a lot of the time in the present it's not satisfaction, it's a feeling of dissatisfaction. And in the past it's always been about doing the next thing to feel that moment of satisfaction and then extend as long as possible, linger on the satisfaction of that accomplishment as long as possible to keep at bay the baseline of dissatisfaction of the distance between my perception and existence. So the more my attention is able to go on the distance and the dissatisfaction of the distance and yet not do anything about it and actually find satisfaction in distance and in dissatisfaction, um, well, the better, really. Because the other wasn't working. You know, decades and decades of trying to close the gap, trying to build the ladder to heaven, trying to summon the will from what is I to ascend to where God is. Well, no. Exhausting all the energy of that, of the ego, while the body is still, has still enough energy to live, seems to be the goal, essentially. And well, it's a razor's edge, or it's cutting it very fine, because I am getting less and less energy physically, so I'm getting older and tireder. But that is nature's course. And I think they're inseparable, because will, I mean, will is only pure if it comes from the body anyway. So the will to do things physically, well, it can't. It doesn't translate into this, what she calls the supernatural realms, the transcendental, the spiritual realms, because there's no body there in the eternal. Nobody there. Okay, moving on. It is one of those things which are added unto us. Every dream of friendship deserves to be shattered. It is not by chance that you have never been loved. To wish to escape from solitude is cowardice. Friendship is not to be sought, not to be dreamed, not to be desired. It is to be exercised. It is a virtue. We must have done with all this impure and turbid border of sentiment. Do not allow yourself to be imprisoned by any affection. Keep your solitude. The day, if it ever comes, when you are given true affection, there will be no opposition between interior solitude and friendship, quite the reverse. It is even by this infallible sign that you will recognize it. Other affections have to be severely disciplined. Well, there's a passage before that. It is a fault to wish to be understood before we have made ourselves clear to ourselves. It is to seek pleasures in friendship and pleasures which are not deserved. It is something which corrupts even more than love. You would sell your soul for friendship. The desire to be liked. The desire to be approved of. The desire to be validated. Bob. In order to feel true gratitude, the case of friendship being set aside, I have to think that it is not out of pity, sympathy, or caprice that I am being treated well. It is not as a favour or privilege, nor as a natural result of temperament, but from a desire to do what justice demands. Accordingly, he who treats me thus wishes that all who are in my situation may be treated in the same way by all who are in his own. Evil. This chapter starts on page 69, and there's a lot in it, predictably enough, that I've marked. Evil is limitless, but it is not infinite. Only the infinite limits the limitless. One is condemned to false infinity, that is hell itself. I'll have to read the whole passage, because that line, this is a key one. Monotony of evil. Never anything new, everything about it is equivalent. Never anything real, everything about it is imaginary. It is because of this monotony that quantity plays so great a part. A host of women, Don Juan, or of men, Selimane, etc. One is condemned to false infinity, that is hell itself. So yeah, prisoner infinity, of course, is about prisoner of false infinity, the creation of a false infinity, which is limitlessness. If one were to try and imagine all the possible phenomena in this existence that every human being could experience, including the ones that haven't happened, that are just potential, throughout all of time, from the beginning of existence to the end of physical existence, that is a virtual infinity, and yet it is a number. It's an inconceivable number. Like, well, well beyond counting every grain of sand on every planet, in every galaxy, in every universe in the cosmos, kind of thing, kind of infinity. It's, that's not what infinity is. That's what the linear mind has created out of the mathematical concept of infinity and the metaphysical reality of God, that which is beyond space, time, and quantity, the quality that transcends all quantities. We have made the mistake of extrapolating somehow that the infinite is very, very large, when it might just as well be very, very small. Infinite and infinitesimal are equally inconceivable and unreachable. The distance between the largest number and infinity is the same as the distance between the smallest fraction and infinitesimality. And that distance is equal to infinity. Like, there's no way to approximate the infinite. One can't get closer to it, no matter how long one were to exist for, or how far one were to travel, or how high one were to count, and so on. So the false infinity, again, it relates to this mistaken notion that God as the Most High is something that we can aspire to from where we are now through our own action. But it's a journey of zero distance, and if it's zero distance, how do we even know which direction to begin it in? Well, there isn't a direction. It's not even inward. It's impossible to begin that journey, never mind end it. But if we begin it, as we all do, it's almost impossible to stop. We keep going, and because we keep going, we keep telling ourselves that we're getting closer. Otherwise the crucial fiction collapses and we're on the cross, we're nailed in the most unbearable position that is imaginable to us, hell. Completely powerless in the hands of all-encompassing evil. And innocent. Completely innocent. Like an unjust punishment that goes on indefinitely by an irredeemable evil. Except the redemption of that evil is that it is redeeming us. Bringing us to the truth, the reality that you can't move forward when you're nailed down. All you do is wound yourself endlessly. Literature and morality. Imaginary evil is romantic and varied. Real evil is gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring. Imaginary good is boring. Real good is always new, marvelous, intoxicating. Therefore, imaginative literature is either boring or immoral, or a mixture of both. It only escapes from this alternative if in some way it passes over to the side of reality through the power of art, and only genius can do that. That which is the direct opposite of an evil never belongs to the order of higher good. It is often scarcely any higher than evil. Examples: theft and the bourgeois, respect for property, adultery and the respectable woman, the savings bank and waste, lying and sincerity. Good which is defined in the way in which one defines evil should be rejected. Evil does reject it, but the way it rejects it is evil. Is there a union of incompatible vices in beings given over to evil? I do not think so. Vices are subject to gravity, and that is why there is no depth or transcendence in evil. We experience good only by doing it. We experience evil only by refusing to allow ourselves to do it, or if we do it, by repenting of it. When we do evil, we do not know it because evil flies from the light. I'd say when we do evil, we generally think we're doing good, which is probably, one could probably flip that around and say that whenever we think we're doing good, we're probably doing evil, which is back to this danger of becoming too self-conscious within one's own virtue. Because that changes the intent, the energy, the attention. If one is doing good and one becomes aware of it, the attention then goes from the recipient of the good to oneself as the doer of the good, and then it becomes a self-serving thing. There's spiritual pride. It's just inevitable. So then one is actually using the recipient of good as a way to feel good, and then one is doing evil to that person. Essentially, one is treating them as an object and a means to an end. And that's so subtle, that can happen so quickly and so subtly, simply with the shift of attention and the awareness of good, of doing good. So, essentially, if one becomes aware that one is doing good, one should stop, I guess, by that definition, or realize that one is doing evil and has to repent of it. Bit of a conundrum, eh? Does evil as we conceive it to be when we do not do it exist? Does not the evil that we do seem to be something simple and natural which compels us? Is not evil analogous to illusion? When we are the victims of an illusion, we do not feel it to be an illusion but a reality. It is the same perhaps with evil. Evil, when we are in its power, is not felt as evil but as a necessity or even a duty. So, I mean, this is one of the reasons that this reading this book has sort of cemented my feeling of powerlessness and despair, because the concepts that she's exploring here and expressing are so profound and so transcendent that they're inherently contradictory, and they lead inevitably always to the recognition that we can't know anything, so we can't do anything without recognizing that we don't know what we're doing, that we might actually be doing evil when we think we're doing good, or vice versa. We can't be self-conscious. We can't be self-aware and be aware of existence at the same time, and that's a terrifying thing to recognize, because self-awareness is existence to us. Without it, we don't exist. It seems like that. I mean, that is true. We don't exist as separate from existence if we don't have self-awareness. So how is it possible to relinquish self-awareness? How is it possible for Christ to get on the cross, to let himself be taken into the hands of evil when he was innocent? Because he was innocent, it was possible. That's all. It is the innocent victim who can feel hell. That was well timed. The false God changes suffering into violence. The true God changes violence into suffering. Got a real deja vu then. A hurtful act is the transference to others of the degradation which we bear in ourselves. That is why we are inclined to commit such acts as a way of deliverance. I think that's a key sentence. Like those who commit evil against others, cruelty, willful cruelty, do so in the spirit and the belief that somehow they're redeeming themselves and or the other by doing it. Back to this, the ultimate evil, the utmost evil, is done with the conviction that it is good. And weirdly, almost the same the other way around, that the ultimate good or good can only really happen when we're convinced of our own evil. When we know that we're incapable of doing good, then we can act with goodness.
Wanderer of the stars, nothing in your night has froze. Goodbye, Oslo Rose. One roar of the stars, this fate, and so it goes. Goodbye, Oslo Rose. One roar of the stars, nothing in your night did close. Goodbye, Oslo Rose. Stars, nothing in your night has froze. Goodbye, Oslo Rose. One roar of the stars, of all the things you chose. Goodbye, Oslo Rose. One roar of the stars, nothing in your night did close. Goodbye, Oslo Rose.
I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, there's some truth in it, but I think there's also a state at which, because one doesn't want to be in AC whipping himself, self-flagellating every moment. It's not about self-judgment. It's about just recognizing our propensity for evil and how that propensity is innate within us, and it's never absent. It's like a radioactive substance that we've ingested. We irradiate that. And when goodness comes through us, it comes from outside of us. Even if it comes from within us, it's coming from outside of us. And that, the value of that isn't I'm a wretched sinner, that's part of it, but it's, and humility, and it's not that humility is the end, but more of the means, or that allows for that. The value of it is that it allows our attention to go to what is outside of us that is within us, that is good. That is not the opposite of evil, but that is a higher existence that has no opposite, as good without an opposite. And somehow that can land and incarnate in us only insofar as we experience the forsaken agony of Christ on the cross. We are utterly bereft of God, abandoned by God. Somehow that's just the way it is. Because, I mean, it can't be any other way. Like, we're already caught in this impossible conundrum of existence, so why wouldn't the solution or the answer appear to be an impossible conundrum of existence? You know, the cure has to match the ailment. Okay. All crime is a transference of the evil in him who acts to him who undergoes the result of the action. This is true of unlawful love as well as murder. When there is a transference of evil, the evil is not diminished but increased in him from whom it proceeds. This is a phenomenon of multiplication. The same is true when the evil is transferred to things. Where then are we to put the evil? We have to transfer it from the impure part to the pure part of ourselves, thus changing it into pure suffering. The crime which is latent in us we must inflict on ourselves. In this way, however, it would not take us long to sully our own point of inward purity if we did not renew it by contact with an unchangeable purity placed beyond all possible attack. Patience consists in not transforming suffering into crime. That in itself is enough to transform crime into suffering. Raskolnikov turned suffering into crime, and then, of course, his crime turned into suffering. Those first 40 years of my life, or so, I mean, not my childhood, but of my reckless, regretful actions, I was turning suffering into crimes and sins. And it was like I was racking up an account by which the rest of my life would allow, give me the raw material to turn something into suffering, to turn all those crimes into suffering, and so recognize my responsibility for my own evil and therefore regain innocence within it. We're not born innocent. I wasn't. None of us are, I don't suppose, if I wasn't. It's not original sin, it's original toxin, toxicity, which is the same, because it's ancestral sin. It's not ours, but it becomes ours. The serpent that we have fed in place of a fish, we ingest it, becomes who we are. And so we have to act it out. We can't help that. And then, with God's grace, we see the folly of our actions. We persist in our folly long enough to become wise enough to see that we're pale criminals, striking out at images of our own lost innocence. And then the remorse of that we've slayed all that was left of what was good in us. Well, not all of it. We've done our best. That remorse is conscience, like a true conscience, as in the consciousness of what is innocent that cannot be slain. It is not the suffering we inflict on ourselves, but that which comes to us from outside, which is the true remedy. Moreover, it has to be unjust. When we have sinned by injustice, it is not enough to suffer what is just, we have to suffer injustice. Well, of course there's a paradox in that, because what makes it, if what makes it just is that it is injustice, well, that's the paradox. It's just because as we have sown, so we shall reap. As we have meted out to others, so will be meted out to us, to ourselves. But vice versa also, the hand we were dealt is the hand we get to play. But the only thing that changes is awareness, is consciousness. And if we're just the innocent victim, we'll never become aware of our own complicity and our own propensity for injustice and evil. I mean, that doesn't happen. We are always complicit. So as we become aware of our own injustice, we recognize that the injustices done to us are just, and therefore we cease to see others as unjust. We cease to judge others because we have learned to judge ourselves, and so we don't have to be judged. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Judge yourself, that ye not be judged by others, by God. God doesn't judge us, but God metes out to us that which we have meted out to others, and we experience that as judgment, unless we become aware. Awareness is like innocence, they're very closely aligned, like only innocence is truly aware, but also with the deeper our awareness, the more innocent we become. If someone does me an injury, I must desire that this injury shall not degrade me. I must desire this out of love for him who inflicts it, in order that he may not really have done evil. That's a truly compassionate response. The saints who are, or those who are nearly saints, are more exposed than others to the devil, because the real knowledge they have of their wretchedness makes the light almost intolerable. Because the devil that we're exposed to is the devil in us. Of course, that's when the devil really gets to us, is when he influences us internally, when we let him in. And the more aware we are of how we've been infiltrated, the more painful it is to recognize our innocence. Very paradoxical. Okay, once an atom of pure good has entered the soul, the most criminal weakness is infinitely less dangerous than the very slightest treason, even though this should be confined to a purely inward movement of thought, lasting no more than an instant, but to which we have given our consent. That is a participation in hell. So long as the soul has not tasted of pure goodness, it is separated from hell, as it is from paradise. Makes sense, you can't lose what you never had. It is only possible to choose hell through an attachment to salvation. He who does not desire the joy of God, but is satisfied to know that there really is joy in God, falls, but does not commit treason. When we love God through evil as such, it is really God whom we love. That was a difficult one, so I didn't mark it, but I read it anyway. We have to love God through evil as such, to love God through the evil we hate while hating this evil, to love God as the author of the evil which we are actually hating. I think to me that was the kernel that I felt I discovered in the Old Testament, even though having read more of it since then, I'm really put off it again. But I still want to hold on to what was perhaps that kernel, that the goodness in the Old Testament God is in the opportunity that it presents, that description, to love a God even who commits evil, because, well, I guess there's two ways to do it. You see, one is the slavish way that actually creates a demiurge, a false god, and the other is the way in which the saint loves the sinner, even, that Christ loves all beings, that we can even love a false god, we can even love a false representation of God, we can even love. Well, I mean, the conundrum, or the problem that religious people have, and non-religious even, or anti-religious, is that how can a good God commit evil? The solution to that in the Old Testament is God is only evil towards sinners, and the reason that that God is such a badass is because the chosen people, the Jews, keep fucking up, and so they basically deserve it. But then, of course, why did God choose a people if they were going to fuck up so much? It's similar to, you know, if God gave us free will, knowing that we're going to commit evil, then how is that not God's fault? You know, why didn't He design us better so that we could have free will and actually not commit evil, and so on? These arguments really go nowhere because they're all on a temporal plane of cause and effects, and so fuck it. I'm going to edit that part out. Edit. I'm just talking. I mean, I was just trying to hold it together when I'd lost it. I don't want to do that. Using will. I thought maybe I'd get that, but I didn't. Alright, well, actually it's been an hour. So, I'm pretty sure that the death agony is the supreme dark night which is necessary even for the perfect if they are to attain absolute purity. For that reason it is better that it should be bitter. Well, that's an optimistic outlook. Even to dwell in imagination on certain things is possible, quite a different thing from clearly conceiving the possibility of them, which is essential to virtue, is to commit ourselves to them already. Curiosity is the cause of it. We have to forbid ourselves certain things, not the conception of them, but the dwelling on them. We must not think about them. We believe that thought does not commit us in any way, but it alone commits us. A license of thought includes all license. Not to think about a thing, supreme faculty. Purity is negative virtue. Not to think about a thing is supreme faculty. Free will is in not to think about things that do not lead to anything real. Evil has to be purified or life is not possible. God alone can do that. This is the idea of the Gita. It is also the idea of Moses, of Muhammad, of Hitlerism. But Jehovah, Allah, Hitler are earthly gods. The purification they bring about is imaginary. That which is essentially different from evil is virtue accompanied by a clear perception of the possibility of evil and of evil appearing as something good. The presence of illusions, which we have abandoned, but which are still present in the mind, is perhaps the criterion of truth. Right. So I find that affirming too, because so much of my life has been about identifying my illusions. And of course I don't forget them. I've written books about them. I memorialize illusions. It's like they're the frame or the backdrop that allows the truth to be visible, because truth is somehow ineffable. It's like illusions identified point towards reality. At least if there's a coherent, consistent pattern in the identification, I'd say. It's like panning for gold. Like, we learn to separate the dirt from the gold, not because we can get gold, but because then we learn about that process of evaluation by which we can recognize gold, and then that can be extended to other things too, because it's an innate sense within the soul to discern what is of value that is always present, hence zero distance from us. But if we don't know where to direct our attention, it's as if it's not there. We cannot have a horror of doing harm to others unless we have reached a point where others can no longer do harm to us. Then we love others to the furthest limit, like our past selves. The extreme affliction which overtakes human beings does not create human misery, it merely reveals it. sin and the glamour of force. Because the soul in its entirety has not been able to know and accept human misery, we think that there is a difference between human beings, and in this way we fall short of justice, either by making a difference between ourselves and others, or by making a selection among others. This is because we do not know that human misery is a constant and irreducible quantity which is as great as it can be in each man, and that greatness comes from the one and only God, so that there is identity between one man and another in this respect. It's a very, very hard pill for me to swallow, for many of us, I believe. There is in every degree of distance between the creature and God. There is every degree of distance between the creature and God. A distance where the love of God is impossible. Matter, plants, animals. Here, evil is so complete that it destroys itself. There is no longer any evil. Mirror of divine innocence. We are at the point where love is just possible. It is a great privilege, since the love which unites is in proportion to the distance. God has created a world which is not the best possible, but which contains the whole range of good and evil. We are at the point where it is as bad as possible, for beyond is the stage where evil becomes innocence. The devil is a dark point on the horizon approaching. Until that time, he will remain as a flat pole on your chair of despair. That last wasn't Simone Weil. It was something that was delivered to me by a voice when I was 20, and I've never forgotten it, and I was just reminded of it by that. For beyond is the stage where evil becomes innocence. All contradictions are reconciled in God. The good that transcends good and evil must also encompass good and evil, because it can only transcend if it also partakes of that which it transcends. It can't just be some aloof realm that's disconnected. And that, of course, is an inherent paradox, such as that of the incarnation is an inherent paradox. And I think that the answer, in quotes, is in that being on that threshold until one is pulled over it, not using will to cross over the threshold, but eventually there's, I guess, gravity keeps us from crossing over, and only grace can propel us over it. But when it does, what's discovered, I think, is that the paradox of the incarnation and of evil being innocence, somehow an expression of God's innocence to finite mortal man, is recognized as being only a paradox in mind, conceptually. It's not like when we embody the paradox that is the incarnation, there is no paradox, because we become the bridge between those opposites. So we don't perceive it as paradox, existence is, and there's no commentary. There's nothing to make coherent or reconcile. I got another hour's worth out of Simone Weil, so I'm gonna wind up this first part of this discussion. That took us to page 79, Gravity and Grace. That's almost exactly halfway through, a little bit less maybe, but I got less notes in the second part anyway. So let me know what you think. It's good to get your feedback. As I said before, I'm going to put together a workshop, God's Lonely People, in the weeks after my return from Europe. So that'll be the end of August, beginning of September. It'll be an autumn workshop. If there is interest, there'll be some nominal charge, sliding scale. If you're interested already, without knowing more about it, just email me, Jason with a U at protonmail.com. And if you want to support this podcast, you can do so. Thanks to those who have supported it. Don't have your names offhand. Got a nice $100 donation today from Brendan. Thanks for that. And thanks to everyone else who has supported this podcast, The Loneliness Between.
On the streets of old Milwaukee was a young boy walking. It was said by the men who lived there, beware of that boy. But I shook my head and said, no, 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 it's so. I was waiting at the bus stop when a boy came near. He said, sir, can you spare some change for a poor boy's daily meal? Yeah.
it's the rest of mankind.